Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Susan Greylock Usom, a host of the New Books Psychology Channel, and today we'll be talking to Mary Jane Rust about her new book, Towards an Eco-Psychotherapy. Mary Jane Rust is an eco-psychologist, art therapist, and Jungian analyst. Her numerous publications include the timely book, Vital Signs, Psychological Responses to Ecological Crisis. She grew up by the sea and now lives and works overlooking ancient woodlands in North London. Welcome to New Books, Mary Jane.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's very nice to be here with you.
This is such a wonderful book. It's not just about the practice of eco-psychotherapy, but what's so wonderful, you also give a great history of eco-psychology, and you talk about new ideas that are emerging and some of the controversies and shadows of eco-psychology. So hopefully we'll touch on all those, but first, it would be great to know what led you to write this book now.
Well, there's the long story and the short story. The long story is that, in a way, coming into the field of eco-psychology, which I discovered in about the mid-1990s, brought together many of my interests that had been always around but had never been threaded together properly. So it was a great joy to me to discover the word eco-psychology, which I think many people feel that, oh my God, this is me, this is what I've always been wanting, to see these different threads of psychology, ecology, spirituality and politics, I would say, are probably the main threads for me included in that word eco-psychology. It was very difficult to meet other colleagues with the same interests, but I did through a new organization that got set up at around that time. And myself and about 9 other colleagues met together as a kind of a self-help eco-psychology group once a month for 5 years. Really, that was my eco-psychology training, because there wasn't a training at the time. And we experimented running workshops for each other before we went and offered them to others. As a group, we attended residentials with Joanna Macy when she came over, and with John Seed, who came over from Australia. They were 2 very important mentors for me. And then gradually I got invited to give talks and to run workshops. And I met up with someone in the early 2000s who was an outdoor educator, and we ran courses in the wilds of Scotland. That was a really key turning point, really, in my practice. And then gradually I started working with individual clients outdoors. That was a huge step after working for 30 years indoors. And gradually I came to see how the eco-psychology world came more into my work as a psychotherapist. It was very hard to see that to begin with, because you're sort of trained in a very particular way of understanding human trauma within human relationships. And I've written lots of different pieces. And then, in fact, this book I was asked to write by an organization called Confer that was just setting up a new publishing company. So the brief was 20,000 words. What are the main themes? What's the history of the field? What are the main ideas? What are the controversies? And what does it look like in practice? So that's how come I, you know, the short story is I was invited to write the book, and the long story is all of that stuff has been brewing for decades.
Yeah, I think that must have been the hard part of the book. It's to get everything so succinctly, because it is a very compact and like very readable little book, but there's so much in there. That must have been the challenge for you as a writer.
It was very, very difficult. I spent a year doing it, and they gave me a few more words. So in fact, it's now 27,000 words, thankfully. but I think I suppose I'm not someone, I mean, I could be very long-winded, but I think I like the idea of trying to get things, complex ideas across in a few words. Because I think we're rather flooded with texts and things to read these days. And it's quite nice to have a nugget of something. And then you can go off and research more if you want to.
Exactly. I think that's what I found so appealing as I was reading it, because I thought originally the audience might be more of a practitioner. And as I read it, I started making a list of people I wanted to give the book to, because so many people ask me, like, what is eco-psychology, or what is eco, you know, what would therapy look like? And I think, oh, this answers it, but there's also all these little seeds that you could follow on your own. You know, they're all there. You can take it and anyone could follow their own path. So has your sense of the audience, did it change during the book, or were you always thinking of it being for a wider audience?
Well, actually, no, really. I suppose as I was writing it, I really wanted to write something for the psychotherapy audience, because I feel like in this country, at any rate, they don't really get it. I think there's a sort of fantasy of people going off and having a nice time in nature, you know, that because psychology is seen in a little bit of a sort of white middle-class fluffy way, and not really getting whereas psychotherapy really is about very difficult and complex work of relationships, and most people don't really see how the two things come together. So I felt it was an important book to write. I also think that the field of ecotherapy has become such a wide umbrella term that the complex and deep work of psychotherapy has got lost in it. And so I wanted to come back to, well, this is how I practice. You know, I work long term with individuals, and it's often very difficult and deep and dark work. So what does that look like when you take it outdoors? Or what does that look like when you bring the threads of an ecological understanding into that work?
That's right. That is what is so specifically unique about it, the psychotherapy piece. And maybe before we dive into those, it'd be worth just teasing apart these few threads to make sure there's a sense of what is eco-psychology, what is eco-therapy, and what is eco-psychotherapy. Yeah. How do you describe simply what eco-psychology is?
Okay, so eco-psychology is really bringing together, as the word suggests, ecology and psychology. And a simple way that I often describe it is, on the one hand, it's how we can bring a psychological attitude or understanding to the shift that we're trying to make in the world. You know, we're kind of stuck like rabbits in headlights. We've got this huge crisis happening around us, but we're not responding to it we just need to really get going with this and work much faster. So it's a psychological problem as much as a practical problem. And I think people tend to think of it as being the work of environmentalists and politicians, but it's not. It's the work of all of us. And it's a huge change that we've got to make. And of course, the practical changes are terribly important, but there's also a much deeper psychological shift that we have to make. And that can include all sorts of things, from climate denial, climate psychology, to looking at the consciousness change that we're being called to make. There's so much more I could say there, but anyway. And then on the other hand, it's how those issues come into our internal worlds. How does all of that, how does the crisis impact on us personally? And in a way, that's going more into the work of ecotherapy and ecopsychotherapy.
And when did ecopsychotherapy start to begin as a practice?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, ecotherapy has been around for a long time, even though it may not have been called that. So we can trace it right back to, I don't know, the 19th century probably, in a sense, it's always been going on. Of course, humans have always known that spending time in the lap of nature is deeply healing, but it's also challenging. You know, it's not just a nice thing, it's also about adventure, it's also about risk. There's all sorts of things, you know, going on there, and it's no accident that we would go off into the wilderness for a rite of passage. Young men young people, particularly young men, say in Southern Africa, being sent off for their rite of passage, about a third of them would not return. I mean, that's staggering. In terms of health and safety in our culture, that wouldn't be allowed to happen. But in their culture, they would understand that this would be an important ritual in turning boys into men.
I think that sometimes gets lost, and people, there might be a sense of ecotherapy being more of a feel-good method where you go and you around the beauty of nature and its healing, but not a sense of the full capacity of the more than human world.
And of course, that whole notion of the sort of fluffy notion of ecotherapy sits within our very domesticated lifestyles and culture. So the very act of, or the very field of ecotherapy itself has become domesticated, just as the work of psychotherapy has in many ways become over domesticated. So the word ecopsychotherapy, I think, I'm not sure when it first emerged, but it's fairly recent. It's definitely within the last decade. And I think it may have come out of this organization, Confer, that asked me to write this book. The organization was set up probably in the early 2000s by a woman called Jane Ryan, and she was organizing conferences for psychotherapists. And it was a one-woman band for a very long time. And she really got ecopsychology, which was fantastic. That meant that Confer as an organization started to put on ecopsychology conferences, maybe once or twice a year, since I think the first one was in 2008. And then somewhere along the line, she came up with the word ecopsychotherapy, or somebody in our community came up with that word. I don't quite know how it happened, but it's now being used quite a lot. And I thought long and hard actually about using it as for this book that I've written, because I didn't want to create another hierarchy. And I think there's always a danger, you know, there's lots of hierarchies everywhere, and that's true of the world of psychotherapy as well. And I didn't want ecopsychotherapy to be seen as better than ecotherapy, but rather as another form of, and that it's important that it's recognized as such, and that it's different to, I don't know, a kind of more of a coaching model of taking people out for a walk and talk session in nature. You know, there's lots and lots of different forms, or animal assisted therapy, or adventure therapy. I mean, there's countless different forms of ecotherapy. And ecopsychotherapy is another form.
That's a good distinction you bring up when you were thinking about how the name, because I think in our consumer culture, possibly adding eco to something is like a value add, and you're making it a little better than, and that's sort of a risk in the terminology.
I also want to say I hate that prefix. It's added to everything all the time. I don't actually really like the term ecopsychology, nor do I like adding eco onto psychotherapy. But I think for the moment, that's what we're stuck with. And for the moment, it describes the field. people get it when you say the word, or they'll be interested and they'll want to find their way in and try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I could say a little bit about how I understand ecopsychotherapy. So firstly, in a sense, to differentiate it from regular psychotherapy, in regular psychotherapy, we're very used to understanding human trauma and human healing as coming out of human relationships. Ecopsychotherapy includes our relationship with the other than human world, with nature. I'm using the rather clunky word other than human world, because I think when I say nature, it immediately creates a dualism between humans and nature, and we're part of nature. So, you know, many of us, I won't say all, because it's not true of everyone, but many of us form deep relationships with animals, with place, with trees, with the elements from year dot, really. I mean, we're all born into water, into the womb. So we have a relationship with the non-human world, of course we do, from the moment we're conceived. And it's very odd, isn't it, that it's been completely left out of how we think about ourselves psychologically. So I think ecopsychotherapy, it doesn't have a theory yet, but it needs to have a theory about child development and how important it is for children to play outdoors, what happens to them when they play outdoors. I'm sure there's tons of research about that and how helpful it is for children. But it's not just that, you know, it's about developing an empathy for animals when we grow up playing or living with animals. And so many people do have pets. And those people know full well that animals, for example, feel pain, or animals feel in much the same way as humans do. They just don't have the intellectual piece added on.
This is an interesting point that I think Jerome Bernstein brought up in one of his books, in particular, the distinction in psychotherapy where there's a tendency, especially in Jungian work, for things to become symbolic in our relationship with animals, or a dream to become to become specific about it. It's a symbol of something, not about the animal. But I think there's a shift to thinking like, no, when you feel pain, when you see animals and other animals in pain, it's because you're actually responding to that pain. We need to sit with that pain. It's not a symbol of my own grief about something in my, it actually is real. And that, I think, is a distinction in how you might approach, especially a Jungian psychoanalysis.
Yes, very definitely. So then ecopsychotherapy is also, it's not just about how we relate to the other than human. It's also about the fact that we're animals. And how do we relate to ourselves as animals, that we're embodied? And this is something that psychotherapy has not been so good at. And I think that, in a sense, we're still suffering from old perceptions of animals as aggressive, animals as just biological beings without the psychological piece, animals who don't feel in the same way as humans, and so on. And so I think there's still this image around of our animal sides as needing to be tamed, that they're wild and they're aggressive, they need to be domesticated. And I think that actually, I think the tide is just beginning to turn with the whole movement of rewilding and people beginning to get the idea that actually maybe humans need rewilding too. and that wild does include being disinhibited and being aggressive, but of course humans are always, you know, it's not just our animal cells, we're all like that anyway. When humans are threatened, we react aggressively in the same way that animals react aggressively when they're threatened. But you know, that actually the wild contains so many gifts that I think we've lost as we've become over-domesticated. So how that we are intuitive beings, that's part of our animal self. We are sensual beings and we are feeling beings. So I think psychotherapy has been great on bringing us back in touch with our feelings. Very important piece, but not so great yet on embodiment and sensuality. And actually intuition is in the balance. I think it's still people still very suspicious of intuition as being unreliable. But in a sense, none of those faculties are reliable on their own. This is what's so important, isn't it? That our culture highly prizes the rational and the intellect, but it must come together with those other faculties before we can create wisdom or find wisdom. And then, of course, the last piece, well, not the last piece, but eco-psychotherapy very much recognises the existence of the ecological crisis and acknowledges that many people will be suffering from eco-anxiety and eco-grief, eco-rage, eco-anything. There I am adding the prefix onto all these feelings again. And offers a space in the therapy for clients to really explore the many different directions that those feelings might take them. Rather than the ghastly things that you hear sometimes about therapists interpreting those as displacement from human relationships. So, you know, someone who is terribly distressed about the felling of the tree in their childhood garden, which they never grieved over, the therapist will try and make that into the loss of the father when the parents got divorced or something like that. Just making that up, but you know,
but in fact, it's very painful to chop down a very big tree that you've seen your whole life, and you know the web of life that revolves around that tree.
And it may well have got entangled in the loss of a father, but the two things are different. And it's absolutely, of course, we need to grieve our losses in the other than human world. Of course we do. And actually for many people, losing a dog or a cat or a guinea pig will be their first experience of grief. So it's terribly important. And that's often missed in therapy because we're not trained to recognize those events as being really traumatic. I had that experience that actually I went through years. I mean, you know how it is when you train as a Jungian analyst or something like that. I mean, years and years and years of frequent therapy. And no one picked up the dog who I lost when I was 13. And it was absolutely devastating, a devastating event. She drowned. She drowned in our garden. And I just cut off. The grief was so overwhelming, I couldn't stand it. And it remained buried for years and years and years, and actually left a trail of what now I think on reflection, a lot of my bodily symptoms that I got after that event was due to unexpressed grief. And it wasn't until I came into the world of eco-psychology and started re-looking at my life story in terms of my relationship with land and the other than human world that I came back to this and realized how it had just been missed out of all those hundreds of hours of therapy. Wow. It's terrible.
You give some really specific examples of technique, and I think having gone through this evolution yourself as a therapist, I think you'll understand that some psychotherapists will be very uncomfortable about breaking some of the, you know, the structure of the therapeutic process, like the room itself. For instance, you bring this up in the book, the container of the room is such an important piece, and you sort of disrupt that possibly by going outside, and which is almost like there's almost taboo some of the things that you might bring up in ecotherapy. So can you say a little bit about that, especially the therapists who are uncomfortable with some of those ideas on the technique?
Well, certainly I can think of two examples of what you're raising, and it's really important. You know, one is that we don't discuss politics in therapy. It's always interpreted. And I think this is the ecological stuff is seen in the same light as we don't discuss politics. We don't discuss the ecological crisis. And actually, there's a Jungian analyst, Andrew Samuels, who's done a lot of work on politics and psychotherapy. And he has always maintained that that there is a political self, just as that there is an ecological self, and that politics is something that can be discussed in the work of psychotherapy, in the process of someone developing their political self, if you like. And I would agree with him there. So that's a very much discussed point of technique that many therapists will have different views on. But certainly, yes, taboo taking therapy outdoors. And in the early days of when I was experimenting with it, I definitely had fears of being struck off, discovered, seen in my local woods as if someone would know what I was doing.
And that there might be a critique that you weren't keeping people safe, right? Because the room is a symbol of safety. And so that's a big move to make as a therapist.
And yes, and people are right to ask questions about it, because the first question that always arises is, but what about confidentiality? So it's not just about keeping physically safe. It's like, well, I live in a big city. I'm working with people in my local woodland, a public woodland. Is this safe? Is this safe from intruders? Would humans walk into the session, but also would people overhear? And obviously you have to attend to those issues. And there may be times where it's not appropriate to work with someone outdoors. Particularly I've found, for example, if someone is going through a long and extended period of talking about childhood sexual abuse, I don't think that public woodland is a good spot to work with my client in to discuss that matter. I personally wouldn't feel safe. And I feel sorry about that, because I feel that actually the outdoors would be a very good space for that sort of person to want, you know, if that's what they want to do. But I think a private garden would be much better, as long as you can't be overheard. I tend to offer my first sessions with clients indoors and make an assessment of whether I think, you know, if they're wanting to work outdoors, and it's always the client's choice, I would make an assessment of whether I think this is a good idea. And I also, you know, you can't have loud emoting in the outdoors. Someone can't shout and scream or sob endlessly for the duration of the session. So it's limiting in that respect. So those are the sorts of things that one has to think about. And it's not for everyone.
One interesting thing that I think if you bring therapy outdoors, it might happen more. I'm curious if your experience of this is synchronicity. I've always wondered if when you're out, I mean, my own experience is there's more opportunity almost for these synchronistic things to happen. And I think in your book, you beautifully called synchronicity the grace offering. Can you say a little more about that role in psychotherapy and how you may see it differently or in outdoor settings or in eco-psychotherapy in general?
Well, I think you're right that there's more opportunity for it to happen outdoors. So what I find is that in a sense, you're opening the door of the session to other beings to come in and join in with you in the session. And that can happen very frequently, I find. It doesn't always happen. You know, I think I had a session the other day outdoors, and the two of us were just sitting on a tree trunk and totally focused on what was being said. And to be honest, we would have had exactly the same dialogue indoors. but it was very nice being in the woods. But it wasn't necessarily impacted. The session itself wasn't necessarily impacted by being outdoors. But other times with other people, all kinds of things might happen. I mean, I remember one time working with a client whose mother had died several months previously, and she was in the thick of mourning. And she came to a point in the session and she turned to me and she just said, "There is no new life." And in that moment, an acorn dropped from the tree above into her lap. So nature spoke. Nature said, "There is new life. Here's a seed for you." Now, it wouldn't have worked if I'd said something like that. And I'm as a therapist, I don't do reassurance, you know, that's not my role. So when she says there is no new life, I'm simply a witness to her saying that. Or, you know, I might mirror back. That's a hard place to be in at the moment. I hear you, something like that. But nature is saying there is. And she just burst out laughing. She just got it immediately. So there's things like that, the ways in which animals and the trees and the wind intervene. I remember in another session, someone who, I can't remember exactly what she's talking about, but she was in a very painful place. And then the wind blew and she smelt roses on the wind. I mean, there were no roses anywhere near us, but it was as if something blew through her, and her whole perspective in that moment shifted in quite a deep way. It was a very beautiful moment. So, it's hard. It's really hard for me to express in words how profound these moments are. But I think it's, in a sense, you know, that's why I sort of end up giving examples. But in a sense, I think it's an affirmation for all of us about the interconnectedness of everything. I mean, it's just extraordinary when it happens, and the timing of it as well. It's just amazing.
It's one of those things in eco-psychotherapy. It's hard to describe. You had to be there to understand how incredibly profound the smell of roses was. I think we get a sense of it, but. And so it's, you use a phrase, the ecological self. And to me, as I'm listening into you, I'm hearing, you know, that the setting and the form helps to cultivate through the process, this ecological self. Can you say more about that and what that means?
Well, I think the ecological self is the part of ourselves that knows that we are nature. I think it can go in lots of different directions. It's very hard to describe the ecological self. But Arne Næss, a Norwegian eco-philosopher who first coined the word ecological self, said that it was the part of ourselves that could identify with the other. I think it probably stretches out a lot more than that. In a sense, sometimes you can have a glimpse, you know, when you go out for a walk, when I go out for a walk, I will have a moment, say I'm on the cliff tops overlooking the sea, and I breathe in and I just have a moment of feeling that I'm this tiny speck, but I'm part of everything. And so the small I is aware of the small I, but I'm also expanded right out. So I think of that as my ecological self, that it goes beyond the boundaries of my skin. And a sense, so I think that's Arne Næss, meaning that I can identify with the other, I can feel with, the bee that's trying to get out of my shut window and it's suffering. I can feel with that animal. So there's something that of me that goes beyond my skin. And we can also think of it as going back in time, you know, to feel with our ancestors. We can think of it as something that goes forward As many Indigenous cultures talk about thinking seven generations. That's what we need to be doing now. We mustn't be doing anything that has a negative impact on seven generations ahead of us. So thinking sustainably, I mean, I think it's a much more exciting word than thinking sustainably. Thinking seven generations is much more inspiring and imaginative, isn't it? To imagine all the generations going ahead of us.
Well, this is a good prelude to talking more about the shadow side of eco-psychotherapy and eco-psychology. There's certainly troubling aspects that you bring up in the book, really in a good way. Can you talk a little more about some of that? You've already talked about the trouble with language and dualistic thinking, but can you say more about the shadow of eco-psychotherapy?
Well, I'm sure it's got many shadows, because everything has many shadows, I think. But I'll pick out two. One is to do with how we so easily get caught into the ways of the dominant culture. So I think there is a tendency for some ecotherapists to make their offering in a sense of going out into nature to get healed. So it becomes like another version of consuming nature. I will go into the forest to take what I want. I want the forest to make me better, and then I will go home again. It's vital that we don't get into that, and we don't get into thinking that, you know, oh, let's go out into nature and see the pretty bluebells and just make everybody feel all right again. Actually, we don't feel all right, and we need to not feel all right, because the world is very troubled and we need to be feeling with the world. There's so many crises right now going on. It's very hard to feel with all of them, isn't it? But we, in a sense, we need to stay with the trouble. So I've never seen psychotherapy as something just to make me feel better. It's actually something that helps me explore my troubles, to stay with the trouble. So I may end up feeling worse at the end of a session, but that's because it's got me more in touch with things, more in touch with my feelings that I need to be working through. So eco-psychotherapy, ecotherapy needs to have reciprocity at the heart of it. We need also to be thinking about what we give back. And for that reason, when I enter into the woods with a client, we make a threshold and I invite them, or invite us together, to ask permission to go into the forest. The forest is a community of beings. Do we just have the right to march in there and do our work and come out? I think it's better to stand at the threshold and ask permission to go in and just hear what the woods say. And so far I haven't been refused entry. I've always had an enthusiastic response of yes, please come in, you're welcome. And my clients have reported that too. But I have been refused permission to sit in a particular spot, for example. Who knows what that was actually about? Maybe it wasn't a good spot for me in that moment. Anyway, that's a big piece. The other big piece of shadow in the world of eco-psychology and eco-psychotherapy is that it's been a very white middle class movement. And of course, naturally, you know, it's arisen within a white community feeling very unhappy with what they see to be going on and how disconnected we are from the natural world, how we see ourselves superior to nature, and this needs to change. So that's come out of white culture. But where we sit now is that naturally many ecotherapists go to Indigenous cosmologies and Indigenous practices to seek inspiration. Many people borrow those practices without permission. Many people offer those practices in their workshops and charge money for them. And this is really against the principles of Indigenous peoples, and they're very cross about it, rightly so. I mean, cross is the understatement of the year. It's really obscene, actually, that we should be taking these things after what white culture has done to Indigenous peoples over the years. So a lot of work needs to be done in our communities to change this around. And I think one of the things that's happening, which is inspiring, is that many white people are now realizing that they need to look at their own ancestors for inspiration. It's not quite the same, because our ancestors, our Indigenous ancestors, are not living. So we can't learn from a culture which is alive. And that's pretty huge, really. But I think we can piece things together. You know, I think we can listen to our own bodies and what they say when we go and spend time in the other than human world. There are many, many stories that have been passed down through the generations, and the stories themselves are really good teachers. So there are many people involved in rejuvenating Indigenous white culture. If we're allowed to use that word, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that white people can ever call themselves Indigenous, or should ever call themselves Indigenous, because I think it's become a political word. And it's not, you know, being Indigenous is not just about connecting to the land. It's about so many different complex issues. So I probably prefer to put that word down in for myself and just talk about how can we reconnect to the land and to the other than human world, and learn from other people that are doing that already.
So there is a recognition within eco-psychology around a lot of the practices that eco-psychology is looking for are core to Indigenous cultures, and there's a risk of appropriating them when that's not recognized or remembered, that the rupture, this field is situated in a Western cultural context, and correcting a Western rupture that hasn't actually occurred in Indigenous cultures.
Yeah. I think there's much more of a recognition in the States, because I think the issue of stealing from native cultures is very alive. There's a living Indigenous culture there to speak back when their voices are finally heard by white people. But I hear a lot of those people saying, actually, this is not okay. And of course, we don't have that here. But I think that the waves that are happening in the world of eco-psychology in the States are definitely rippling over here. And so I think it's becoming much more of a live issue over here. Yep.
Something that you brought up a few times and that is worth noting, I think, is that eco-psychology in general is looking at changing a system. I mean, politics are a part of it, because it can't really exist in the current system. And so by default, part of the work of eco-psychology is political and social and cultural. So it's always sort of in this different place.
I totally agree. How can it not be political? Because how we see the other than human world has been shaped by our culture. How can that not be political? There are so many shadow projections that we make onto the non-human world. And that is one of the pieces of psychological work that's so important for us to do at this time. I mean, you know, we're still arguing, sorry, I'm going to raise my voice here. We're still arguing in the UK as to whether animals are sentient beings. that is in process. And I mean, at least it is in process in the law, but there is a law just coming into being over here. And it's just, you know, it's having to go through the usual stages that new laws have to go through to be passed. But it is unbelievable that we are still at that stage. And just that one example shows the kinds of projections that we have about the non-human world. How can we possibly think that they don't feel pain and that they're not sentient, and the terrible, terrible atrocities that go on because Western people have come to believe that animals can't feel pain. So much work to do.
Well, how do you suggest someone engage with the ideas of eco-psychotherapy, in particular someone that might not have access to therapy or eco-psychotherapy? What are some of the, you bring up a few ideas which I think are interesting, of just ways you could change your own thought process or approach. Do you have suggestions for that?
Well, I think one of the most powerful things to do is to develop a daily practice, which I have had for many years. So one of the things I love doing is swimming in outdoors. And I'm really lucky. I live in North London, and about 2 or 3 miles from where I live is a place called Hampstead Heath. And on Hampstead Heath are 3 swimming ponds that have been made by, they're actually fed by a spring. Can you believe it? Like 4 miles from central London, there is a spring which you can drink out of. And that feeds a whole series of ponds that were actually created in the 19th century. They were a river and they've been made into ponds. Some of them are humans aren't allowed into, so they're just for wildlife. There's one for women, one for men, and then there's a mixed pond. And the women's pond is the most amazing sanctuary. So I can go, it's been a bit difficult because of COVID, so we have to now book sessions and it's time limited, but hopefully that will change and go back to how it was. So it's a place you can just go and hang out. It's quite a large pond. You can swim with heron, with moorhen, with kingfisher. I've swum twice with snakes swimming across the pond. So all of which is to say that actually if you go to the same place each day and you spend, say, an hour in that space, you really get to know it in all of the different seasons, and different animals and birds that come and go, different plants in different seasons, and then of course being immersed in the water. And I find that not only healing, I generally tend to go after I've seen a series of clients in the morning, so it's a wonderful way to refresh myself. If I feel a bit clogged up with other people's stuff, then I go into the water, and the water will help me to discharge any emotion that I might be holding on to. But other people, you know, will have a particular tree who they like to go and sit at the foot of, or they will have several different spots. You know, maybe you like to go and sit on a seat high above with a view when you're making a decision. It's interesting how getting perspective and having a view helps us to decide something. Or if we're feeling a bit down, then maybe we want to find a more enclosed space in the forest. So there might be a range of different places, but I think to get to know a place and to sit and to just let your mind become empty and to notice the connections between what's going on outside and what's going on inside. And that can be a really beautiful practice. I did last winter, I went to one of my spots, which was under a tree. I was due to have a tooth out the next day, and I was a bit perturbed because also my lovely woman dentist had referred me on to a male dentist in the same practice for whatever reason. And I was a bit anxious about having this unknown man take my tooth out. And so anyway, I went and sat at this spot by the tree, and within, I don't know, 5 minutes, a robin had come and was jumping around my feet. And of course, robins usually are quite they like to come quite close to humans, but this was particularly close. Anyway, I sat there and I didn't move. And then the robin came and sat next to me on the bench. And then it went off and collected a few more grubs. And then it came back and sat next to me on the bench again. And then it jumped onto my knee. I was absolutely amazed. And it did it. It did these rounds, you know, going off, collecting, coming back, sitting next to me, jumping onto my knee, jumping onto the other knee, and then doing it. And I realized at the end of it that my anxiety levels had just completely dissipated, and that this relationship with this little feathered being had just calmed me down, ready for my tooth to be taken out.
That's a great example. You also talk in the book about knowing your own earth story, which I think is an important thing for us all to think about, our personal story, because we all have one and we don't think about it. We are more likely to project onto other people or beings or cultures. And I think we might forget that no matter where you grew up or what your background is, you have an earth story, and so do your past generations in your family.
Yes, it can be really, really potent to, say, get together with a friend or even create a small group for everyone to exchange their earth stories. I mean, if anyone is anxious about the ecological crisis, I really would suggest gathering together in small groups, and how potent it is to have other people witness your anxiety, your grief, your rage about what is going on. But it doesn't just have to be a place for bringing very difficult feelings. It can also be a place to share your relationship with the earth. And you can start by sharing your earth stories. And also, if you get into the practice of visiting a particular place each day, it's lovely to share those experiences too with other people.
What do you see on the horizon for eco-psychology and eco-psychotherapy?
I think, judging by the last few years, I think there's been a huge increase in interest in this field. We set up an online eco-psychology community in about 2008 in this country, and there's still people joining in hordes. If anyone's interested, it's www.ecopsychologyuk.ning.com. And although it's UK-based, it's open for anyone around the world to come and join. What was your question?
What do you see on the horizon? So you see more involvement.
So I think that actually what I would love to see is the psychotherapy world getting more and more engaged with these issues. And I think there are signs that this is happening. There's another group, if listeners are interested, called the Climate Psychology Alliance. That has an email list, so it has a live discussion group. But it also has a great website with all kinds of subgroups that you can come and join. And judging by those sorts of communities, more and more people are getting interested in these areas. As I think more and more people are waking up to how real the crisis is, and therefore more and more people are suffering from eco-grief and eco-anxiety, there's been a huge increase in interest in the media. So in the last year or two, I have just had countless journalists getting in touch with me saying, please, can I interview you on eco-anxiety? So I think it is getting out there. And I think the field will go from strength to strength. And I would love to see a more robust theory developing and a more robust discussion of some of the conflictual issues within the field, because that's how things grow, really. I don't know if this is happening in the States or elsewhere, but certainly in the UK, what's been developing is, as well as more thinking in the field, a diverse range of practices have been developing. So some leading people in the field over here are people like Nick Totten, who's written a book called Wild Therapy, which is excellent. Someone else called Ian Siddons Heggingworth has developed environmental arts therapies. A woman called Caroline Brazier has developed a Buddhist ecotherapy. And someone called Martin Jordan has written about taking therapy outdoors. He's written a little handbook called Nature and Therapy, which is excellent for any therapist thinking of setting out in this field. So I think there will probably, we will see more and more people developing Gestalt ecotherapy, Jungian ecotherapy, and so on and so forth.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We've taken a lot of your time, but before we go, is there anything else you'd like to add or something that's exciting to you in your work right now that you're working on?
Well, I think this, two things I would say that are, I think the thing that excites me the most at what's going on in the world is the rewilding movement. There's been some fantastic developments in the UK. There's a huge estate of 3,500 acres just south of London called the Knepp Estate. And they started rewilding in the 1990s. It's quite a thing to turn over an estate that size that has always been farmed to rewilding. And of course, they haven't just left the land to itself. They've done all sorts of things like introducing particular kinds of animals that come in and churn up the land. And there's a book called, by Isabella Tree, called Wilding, if you're interested to read about that. But what's so fantastic is looking at the speed at which nature will heal herself if given the right conditions, and also the way in which this has come into the media. You know, so on one of our national news programs, Channel 4 News, you've got Jon Snow, who's really aware of these issues, saying, "And the white stork has returned to the Knepp Estate. This is amazing." And all these people are getting really excited about what's returning. And then that has inspired a whole raft of people rewilding their land. There's so many different projects now. So, and then I think from a psychological point of view, it's really interesting to think about how we rewild ourselves. What does that actually mean? And I suppose this is what I've been trying to do in writing my book and in developing the field of ecopsychotherapy. And the other piece that I'm working on, literally working on at the moment, is a chapter for a Jungian anthology on the shadow. And I've been asked to write the chapter on the ecological and the shadow. It's another interesting piece.
That'll be a wonderful contribution to Jungian thought.
I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for this great book. I'm Susan Greylock-Usom, and this is the New Books Network, and we've been speaking with our guest Mary Jane Rust about her new book, Towards an Eco-Psychotherapy. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.